Mars tugs at the human imagination like no other planet. With a force mightier than gravity, it attracts the eye to the shimmering red presence in the clear night sky. You are listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Hello, and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Professor Dave, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University in London, Ontario, Canada. Our opening quote today was from John Noble Wilford's novel, Mars Beckons. When dark, linear features were first noticed on Mars by early astronomers, they were mistaken as canals transporting water. Today, we search with far better telescopes, satellites, and rovers, and we search for far smaller, more subtle things. But we are still searching for dark features that might hint at the presence of water. The search for water on Mars is the search for the possible history of life on Mars, and the quest for a possible future for humanity on Mars. We are not searching for purpose-built canals, but streams, or gullies, or just a little bit of melting. The quest is ongoing, but we have certainly found many fascinating features that appear, disappear, and change with the changing Martian seasons. Are these hinting at water? Or winds? Or avalanches? Only a very close investigation can hope to reveal the truth. To tell us a little bit about the various features we observe on the Martian surface, our guest today is Heather Chilton from Cal Poly Pomona University. Enjoy the interview by Raymond Francis.
So Heather, welcome to the show. And here at the Lunar and Planetary Science Conference this year, you're presenting about some types of features you see on the slopes of hills on Mars.
Yes, indeed. So my particular research focus are on what are called dark slope streaks. Now, please keep in mind there are several types of slope features, and they can sort of often overlap and get confused. I know this has been a learning process for myself. Right now, though, the ones that are getting a lot of attention, so the ones that you may have heard in the news and media recently, are two different features. One are gullies, which are mostly located in the southern hemisphere, and you basically have these incisions into the slope where it seems that water, at least at one point, had, you know, sort of cut away into the material and rock there. You also have what are known as RSLs, which are recurring slope lineae, and those are very relatively small-ish features. They range, I believe it was from 0.5 meters all the way up to 5 meters in width and up to a few hundred meters in length. Now, those are sort of getting a lot of attention and are interesting in the sense that they have sort of an annual cycle, and when it gets warmer, they seem to appear, grow, and then when it gets colder, you know, during the day or season, I can't actually remember, they tend to stop or fade out a little bit. So those are getting a lot of attention recently, but my focus has been on what are called dark slope streaks.
And this is something different than the other two.
They are indeed very different in terms of characteristics as well as mechanisms. And these have actually been imaged all the way back since the Viking images. A lot of these other features are very new, but these, I mean, we've been observing these for 30, 40 years now.
Okay. So what makes them look so different from the recurring slope features in the gullies?
Yes, so the dark slope streaks, their width are a few hundred meters in, you know, for their width, and then run as long as up to 1 to 1.5 kilometers.
So they're much larger.
They are much larger. In addition, they occur in areas that, you know, sort of in science talk are high albedo and low thermal inertia, which
What does that mean?
So with the high albedo, it means it's very reflective, which means generally you have a smoother surface. So if you take, for example, the ground outside, the same ground, if you lie it flat, you're going, water or snow or any of that, if it's flat, you're going to have a nice reflective surface. But as soon as you start introducing, knobs and texture to it, you're going to start getting a little more shadows, and that light's going to get, scattered around a little bit more.
So these are surfaces that may have more finer material and fewer boulders and things.
Exactly. And, that could just be, and in this case, it's just that there's an overlying dusty material that sort of smooth things out. And the low thermal inertia deals with the inability to maintain and hold in heat. So light hits it, something like a rock might hold that heat a lot longer, whereas something, say, dust, will just lose it very, very quickly.
And is it just due to the composition of the material that it rapidly loses heat when it gets cold?
Right. It's a combination of that composition as well as just being fine-grained particles. Just more sort of surface area to let it lose as well as that composition.
So it's in those kinds of terrains where you find these larger features.
Exactly. And so the formation on these has been discussed, and it's essentially this dust avalanche. So, here on Earth we have snow avalanches. Well, Mars, they've got dust avalanches.
It seems like dust is everything on them.
If you could walk around, which would be fantastic, mm-hmm. It'd be everywhere.
So how does a dust avalanche work?
Generally, they start at these sort of knobs and ridges, basically areas that are not quite as stable as the surrounding areas. And so whether just by, gravity or, kicked up by a little bit of wind, you sort of initiate at a point this avalanche flow, and it removes sort of a swash of material showing a slightly darker subsurface. And that's what we pick up on, is this contrast with this streak. And it's really only about 10%. So whenever you see images of these, they're definitely contrast stretched.
Okay, they kind of enhance that. The difference in brightness.
Right. Like if you try to pick it out with the naked eye, you might be able to pick them out, but it would be very difficult.
That's interesting. I know on the MSL mission, when they went to that rock nest sand dune, the first place where they were scooping, it was kind of the standard red dusty material. And then when they scooped it away, it was darker inside.
To be honest, I don't know much about why that occurs. The same thing happens with the snow avalanches on Earth, where, if you have that very dry, very cold environment, I'm guessing that it's, an interaction with the air, and that removal just reveals a fresh surface that has not been exposed and has not undergone the same reactions as that surface exposed layer.
So then, do we know about how long the dark feature lasts if it's exposed to air?
That's exactly what my research is about. We are trying to figure out the rate that these features fade. Sort of an interesting note with that, the Viking images, most of those streaks are still there. There are some that have faded. We can't pick them out anymore, but most of them are still there. So these are longer-lived features. Unfortunately, because instrumentation doesn't exactly match up, I am restricted in my analyses of sticking with the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter CRISM images, which really only spans a number of years, as opposed to being able to use images all the way back from Viking.
Why is CRISM particularly useful?
I focus on the 1 micron wavelength band, which basically means that with the atmosphere of Mars, certain wavelengths are able to penetrate through the atmosphere uninterfered with better than others. For example, here on Earth, our atmosphere protects us from UV rays. Well, that means that, that's not going to penetrate through, and sort of vice versa. When making measurements from space, there are certain wavelengths that will come through much clearer and others that will be blocked and you will not get senses on.
They get absorbed by the carbon dioxide atmosphere.
Exactly. And so the 1 micron wavelength is perfect for getting through a clear image through the Martian atmosphere. And not all of the instruments have been designed to be able to use that 1 micron wavelength, as well as the specific calibration of the instrument. Because with the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, they take into account, the distance the spacecraft is from, the feature on Mars, how far Mars is around, in its orbit, a whole combination of things, including the comparison of the surface with sort of a pure reflective surface. And so there's a lot of things that go into the actual brightness value, so to say, of what's being measured.
So the imaging processing techniques have improved over the years.
Yes. Oh, well, that's definitely a good thing.
Yeah.
Okay. And we would hope so.
So what are you seeing with these features? What do they look like?
So with the results that we were getting some areas that showed an overall darkening of streaks. So instead of sort of fading out, they were getting darker. And then in other areas, you know, you'd have sort of all of them fade. And it was this overall jump in contrast of all of the streaks in an imaged area that had us sort of concerned. We still haven't really worked that part out. You know, it may be some sort of interference that we haven't been able to account for. However, there are individual streaks within those imaged areas which do not show that same jump or same change as all of the other streaks.
So as they're evolving in time, they're not all behaving the same way.
Exactly. And that's really where our key is. You know, regardless of whether the overall image has been undergoing some sort of interference, the fact that you have one or two streaks in an area that are not behaving the same way is very indicative of the fact that there is something more interesting going on. And that's really what we've been focusing on. And those particular streaks, some of them indeed, you know, show fading more quickly than the surrounding streaks. And in other cases, they actually darken in respect to these other streaks in the same area.
Interesting. And since, you know, since it seems to be some kind of interaction once they're exposed, what could possibly be causing that?
One of the ideas we're looking at is called streak reactivation.
Okay.
So in the case of streaks that appear to be getting darker relative to the surrounding streaks, you know, it could very well be that, you know, once a dust avalanche has occurred, that as dust settles out from the atmosphere on top to basically ensure that these features fade, that it's not as stable because it hasn't really settled. And so it is more inclined to undergo that reactivation and have another sort of dust avalanche.
So you get a second one along the same path that's already been
right.
Gouged.
And that's that particular part where it's following that same path is a characteristic of these dust avalanches. Because of the momentum that it's carried with them for the grain size, amount of material on the slope, if they run into an area of more dust, it's going to make it very difficult for that flow to maintain itself. And, you know, by the same sort of proxy, if it runs into an older streak, because it's changing the amount of material, it really interferes with the ability that avalanche to continue. So they will follow that same path.
Okay. So once there's a channel, they tend to follow the same
path. Right, exactly.
So where do you find these streaks? Are they in the rims of craters or on hills? Where are they?
Basically anywhere you have that slope. So we do see them in craters. We see them on, you know, a variety of slopes. But they are generally located between 0 and 30 of the northern latitudes.
Only in the north?
For the most part. I mean, I have a couple of locations that are sort of south of that. But predominantly, yeah.
That's interesting. So why would they only mostly be on the northern hemisphere?
Yeah, it has to do sort of with that dusty surface mantle. You know, differences in composition and environments.
So, like, just it happens that this is a part of the planet where there's a lot of these dusty
right.
Landscapes.
And sort of by similarities, the recurring slope lineae, they occur in very specific areas where conditions are right. The nice thing with these features is you have an area in which conditions are right, and you can help identify what composes them and what is sort of these underlying mechanisms based off of some of those characteristics.
And so do you find them, you know, where you're looking at these features? You mentioned other types of slope features. Do they often coexist, or are they completely separate?
The locations I've looked at, they don't really overlap in terms of, you know, at least the ones that I've mentioned. It may come to be that there are different types of dark slope streaks, and we have yet to discover that aspect. And it may be that we find other features that overlap in these areas. But at this point, pretty much, when I look at the dark slope streaks, that's pretty much what's going on with those.
So have we imaged them enough? Because MRO's been there for a few years.
Right.
Have we imaged them enough to have an idea of how often this kind of thing happens?
I don't have a rate for you, but we have observed the formation of streaks. And in fact, several of my image locations include an update where I have additional streaks.
Okay.
Which is really
neat.
You get
the before and after picture.
But the interesting part is, you know, I mentioned a lot of these streaks from the Viking images are still there.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't quite jive with how widespread these features are. Because if most of these streaks are still there from the Viking images, it would make sense that with how many are forming, that Mars would just be covered with these features.
Right.
And it's not.
So if they're long-lived and they're often made, they should be all over the place.
Exactly. So one of the thoughts on that is that when you have these giant global dust storms, it can basically wipe the slate clean. Now, we've seen global dust storms, and they haven't done that yet. So either there's some sort of massive dust storm that we haven't seen, or there's, of course, more science out there just waiting to be explored.
There's some other event that resurfaces or erases them somehow.
Exactly.
How much do they look like the outcome of an avalanche that you'd see on Earth?
So in reference to the snow and avalanches here on Earth, I mean, there are some very obvious similarities in the sense that you have that sort of thin, long feature with a brighter surface sort of surrounding and then that slightly darker revealed surface. Grain sizes and materials are slightly different. Interactions with surrounding landscape and air, slightly different. But, I mean, there's a reason why analogs work.
Yeah.
Because, you have enough similarities, particularly when you talk about these cold and dry places, that you can draw some conclusions.
And is there any reason to think that it's connected with groundwater or the flowing of water, or is it a dry process?
And for a long time, for dark slope streaks at least, that was a big debate. And it's neat. There are a couple of streaks that I've seen images of and read papers on that at the very base, they have these braided downslopes, which is indicative of waters and sort of streams. But because of so many of the characteristics, the fact that they're long-lived, the fact that when they run into nearby streaks, that momentum sort of causes it to no longer sort of overwrite a nearby streak, but instead follow its own path. These things and a few others cannot be explained by water features. I mean, particularly the fact that they're long-lived.
Because the water isn't long-lived.
Right, right. You get any sort of liquid exposure on the surface of Mars, it's not going to last.
So do you have all the data you would want to study these, or do you need more from PRISM and elsewhere?
More, always more. Yeah. First off, I've only really been able to look at about 8 locations. Mm-hmm. Part of the problem is that we haven't had great imaging of all of the planet. We always want to see more new places. Unfortunately, my research requires overlapping images, so I would need images of the same location.
Right, the before and the after.
Right, and it's a little bit harder to get support to re-image a place we've already taken a picture of.
When there's places that haven't yet been seen.
Exactly, okay. Exactly. So, although I have talked with people, and apparently there's a push for re-imaging same locations for these very reasons, not
right.
Just for my research, but people studying the reoccurring slope lineae, we're really wanting to observe short-term and long-term changes, so that may change.
To try and understand the active surface.
Yeah.
Hopefully you're able to get some more of that data, and hopefully future missions perhaps carry the kind of instruments that'll help that out.
That would be fantastic.
In any case, thanks for talking to us, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the conference.
Thank you very much for having me.
You are listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
So I just listened to Raymond's interview with Heather Chilton, who investigates dark slope streaks on Mars. And there are some other types of streaks that we also see. So we've had Tanya Harrison talk about some of her gully work and some of the other types of work. But these are interesting because they're not formed by water, or they don't assume that they're formed by water, that it's actually kind of dust avalanches. And one of the interesting things that she was talking about was how some of them change at different rates and how they really don't understand this and what's going on there. Some have been there since Viking times and other ones are appearing. But why don't they see this as a widespread feature on Mars if they last that long?
I see she mentioned like they particularly appear in a certain part of the planet, and I think Tanya in her previous interview talked about how if it was formed by water it would be affected by the obliquity of the planet, but now these are not really formed by water, they are just like we have avalanches, snow avalanches here, dust avalanches on Mars, so there's probably some reason that we still don't know. They're trying to investigate this and what that particular reason is of just having it in a certain area.
Right, and of course we don't actually know how long they've been there. We know they've been there since the Viking days, but we don't know how long before that. Obviously they've been there, so we don't know how long these features do last.
And she said some do show up every now and then, although I haven't seen one forming. But it's kind of funny how Mars occasionally puts on airs of being a dead planet, and a lot of these streaks have been there for so long, and yet still things happen on this place.
Right, yeah, there's new streaks being formed, and some of the old streaks are being reactivated, as she calls them, becoming darker again. And so the assumption that, I guess, once an avalanche has gone through a certain area, that it's more likely to reoccur in the same area, and that's going to uncover that darkness, the layer underneath the top brightish layer of dust.
Yeah, even if we're not really talking about water, still the idea of probing below the surface of Mars is one of the most important topics to do with Mars. And so it's interesting. It's another one of those ways to get below the surface without doing any work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. And it's another way for us to see yet another type of land feature being formed and changed on Mars. I mean, again, like you said, Dave, that, you know, people think Mars is this dead rocky planet, but a lot of things going on there. And it's interesting how she said that the global dust storms that they thought maybe that's why some of them disappear and reappear, but they've been through these global dust storms and they haven't been erased. So what's causing this weird number of them? Because if they keep forming at the rate that they've been seeing them form, it should be covered, right? The area should be covered. So what is possibly going on there, right?
I also found it very interesting what you talked about, how we could understand how different the layers are compared to the ones exposed to the atmosphere, and how things react with the gases in the atmosphere compared to what's found beneath the darker layers that we actually see after the avalanches. So studying even just the composition or understanding just how they form and what they're made of would probably tell us how it reacts with the gases there in the atmosphere as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, even, I mean, one of Curiosity's goals was to drill just tiny, tiny bit into a rock, right? So it doesn't take very much depth to expose some very interesting things in chemistry that we really don't understand and have no idea what would be going on there. So a natural process like this is very worthwhile.
So another interesting thing she talked about was how these slope features don't really coexist with the other features she was talking about, like the gullies and the RSLs. But I guess maybe that's why, right? They're forming in different areas of the planet, that these dark slope features are found between 0 and 30 degrees. And I seem to recall from Tanya's interview, it was kind of like 30 to 60 in both the southern and northern hemispheres. So maybe that has a lot to do with it.
Yeah, it's still a complex world. There's multiple different features. They're all potentially caused by different things. They're all exploring different facets of Mars.
Mm-hmm. And she talked about how these form where there's that really fine dust. So why is that fine dust only found in that part of that planet as well, right?
Yeah, I think this is one of the main reasons why we should keep investigating Mars while going to other places, because then we need a set of data. She talked about how they saw this in the Viking mission, and if we continue to monitor this for a while, we'll be able to see, or maybe able to guess what's going on there, why we can only find certain things in certain part of the planet. And hopefully we'll have more missions to understand these kinds of processes that go on there. Well, it's completely just dust and no trees there, so understanding just one of the main aspects of that planet would be very helpful in understanding any planet.
As you mentioned, it'd be nice to have more data of this stuff as well, right? She mentioned that the MRO CRISM images, unfortunately, well, I mean, it's a good thing for lots of people that it covers the entire globe or most of the globe, but for her, she needs that coverage over and over again. So hopefully that camera can stay online long enough to give her more data to figure out what in the world is going on with these things.
Yeah, it's funny. We can make missions that are as multi-purpose as we want, but some research just needs some very specific things. And this isn't even that specific. We just need repeated images of one bot.
Yeah, and I guess this is the type of research that kind of comes out of the initial images, right? You see these images and you're like, wait, what are those things?
Yeah, it's
right?
Discovery science right there.
Yeah.
Find something weird and look closer at
exactly.
it.
Exactly. But then, of course, the missions aren't designed to continue that type of research. So either we need to be able to change those mission directives or, like Harsha, you mentioned, sending new missions there.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Parshadi Patel and Michael Forrester and featured an interview by co-host Raymond Francis. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Alyssa Gilbert, Zangi Hu, Dave Kirsch, and Parshadi Patel. Our editors were Anna Noon, Alyssa Gilbert, and Michael Forrester, and I'm Dave Kirsch. Our theme music is Heliosheath by Sean Kim. You can continue the conversation online and listen to past episodes, or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, www.cbsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are @WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are facebook.com/westernworlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope you can join us again next week, right here on astronomy.fm.